This is Audible.
Recorded Books presents an unabridged recording of Blood Meridian, or The Evening Redness in the West, by Cormac McCarthy. Narrated by Richard Poe and directed by Greta Byram. This book is copyrighted 1985 by Cormac McCarthy. This recording is copyrighted 2006 by Recorded Books. The author opens this book with the following three quotes. The first is by Paul Valéry. "Your ideas are terrifying, and your hearts are faint. Your acts of pity and cruelty are absurd, committed with no calm, as if they were irresistible. Finally, you fear blood more and more, blood and time." The second quote that opens this book is by Jacob Boehme. "It is not to be thought that the life of darkness is sunk in misery and lost as if in sorrowing. There is no sorrowing, for sorrow is a thing that is swallowed up in death, and death and dying are the very life of the darkness." The third and final quote to open this book is taken from the Yuma Daily Sun, published on June 13, 1982. "Clark, who led last year's expedition to the Afar region of northern Ethiopia, and UC Berkeley colleague Tim D. White, also said that a re-examination of a 300,000-year-old fossil skull found in the same region earlier shows evidence of having been scalped." And now, Blood Meridian.
Chapter 1. Childhood in Tennessee. Runs away. New Orleans. Fights. Is shot. To Galveston. Nacogdoches. The Reverend Green, Judge Holden, and Affray, Toadvine, burning of the hotel, escape. See the child. He's pale and thin. He wears a thin and ragged linen shirt. He stokes the scullery fire. Outside lie dark-turned fields, with rags of snow, and darker woods beyond that harbor yet a few last wolves. His folk are known for hewers of wood and drawers of water, but in truth his father has been a schoolmaster. He lies in drink. He quotes from poets whose names are now lost. The boy crouches by the fire and watches him. "Night of your birth, 33. The Leonids, they were called. God, the stars did fall. I looked for blackness, holes in the heavens. The dipper stove." The mother, dead these 14 years, did incubate in her own bosom the creature who would carry her off. The father never speaks her name. The child doesn't know it. He has a sister in this world that he will not see again. He watches, pale and unwashed. He can neither read nor write, and in him broods already a taste for mindless violence. All history present in that visage, the child, the father of the man. At 14, he runs away. He will not see again the freezing kitchen house in the pre-dawn dark, the firewood, the washpots. He wanders west as far as Memphis, a solitary migrant upon that flat and pastoral landscape. Blacks in the fields, lank and stooped, their fingers spider-like among the bowls of cotton. A shadowed agony in the garden. Against the sun's declining, figures moving in the slower dusk across a paper skyline. A lone, dark husbandman pursuing mule and harrow down the rain-blown bottomland toward night. A year later, he's in St. Louis. He's taken on for New Orleans aboard a flatboat, 42 days on the river. At night, the steamboats hoot and trudge past through the black waters, all alight like cities adrift. They break up the float and sell the lumber, and he walks in the streets and hears tongues he has not heard before. He lives in a room above a courtyard behind a tavern, and he comes down at night like some ferry-book beast to fight with the sailors. He's not big, but he has big wrists, big hands. His shoulders are set close. The child's face is curiously untouched behind the scars, the eyes oddly innocent. They fight with fists, with feet, with bottles or knives. All races, all breeds. Men whose speech sounds like the grunting of apes. Men from lands so far and queer that standing over them where they lie bleeding in the mud, he feels mankind itself vindicated. On a certain night, a Maltese bosun shoots him in the back with a small pistol. Swinging to deal with the man, he is shot again, just below the heart. The man flees, and he leans against the bar with the blood running out of his shirt. The others look away. After a while, he sits on the floor. He lies in a cot in the room upstairs for 2 weeks, while the tavern keeper's wife attends him. She brings his meals. She carries out his slops. A hard-looking woman with a wiry body like a man's. By the time he's mended, he has no money to pay her, and he leaves in the night and sleeps on the riverbank until he can find a boat that will take him on. The boat is going to Texas. Only now is the child finally divested of all that he has been. His origins have become remote, as is his destiny, and not again in all the world's turning will there be terrains so wild and barbarous to try whether the stuff of creation may be shaped to man's will, or whether his own heart is not another kind of clay. The passengers are a diffident lot. They cage their eyes, and no man asks another what it is that brings him here. He sleeps on the deck, a pilgrim among others. He watches the dim shore rise and fall, gray seabirds gawking, flights of pelicans coastwise above the gray swells. They disembark aboard a lighter, settlers with their chattels, all studying the low coastline, the thin bight of sand and scrub pine swimming in the haze. He walks through the narrow streets of the port. The air smells of salt and new-sawn lumber. At night, whores call to him from the dark, like souls in want. A week, and he's on the move again. A few dollars in his purse that he's earned, walking the sand roads of the southern night alone, his hands balled in the cotton pockets of his cheap coat. Earthen causeways across the marshland, egrets in their rookeries white as candles among the moss. The wind has a raw edge to it, and leaves lope by the roadside and skelter on in the night fields. He moves north through small settlements and farms, working for day wages and found. He sees a parricide hanged in a crossroads hamlet, and the man's friends run forward and pull his legs, and he hangs dead from his rope while urine darkens his trousers. He works in a sawmill. He works in a diphtheria pest house. He takes as pay from a farmer an aged mule, and to back this animal in the spring of the year 1849, he rides up through the latter-day Republic of Fredonia into the town of Nacogdoches. The Reverend Green had been playing to a full house daily as long as the rain had been falling, and the rain had been falling for 2 weeks. When the kid ducked into the ratty canvas tent, there was standing room along the walls, a place or two, and such a heady reek of the wet and bathless that they themselves would sally forth into the downpour now and again for fresh air before the rain drove them in again. He stood with others of his kind along the back wall. The only thing that might have distinguished him in that crowd was that he was not armed.
"Neighbors," said the Reverend, "he couldn't stay out of these here hell holes right here in Nacogdoches. I said to him, said, 'You going to take the Son of God in there with you?' And he said, 'Oh, no, no, I ain't.' And I said, 'Don't you know that he said I will follow you always, even unto the end of the road?' Well, he said, 'I ain't asking nobody to go nowheres.' And I said, 'Neighbor, you don't need to ask. He's a-going to be there with ye every step of the way, whether ye ask it or ye don't. I said, neighbor, you can't get shed of him. Now, are you going to drag him, into that hell hole yonder? You ever see such a place for rain?
The kid had been watching the reverend. He turned to the man who spoke. He wore long mustaches after the fashion of teamsters, and he wore a wide-brim hat with a low round crown. He was slightly wall-eyed, and he was watching the kid earnestly, as if he'd know his opinion about the rain.
"I just got here," said the kid. "Well, it beats all I ever seen."
The kid nodded. An enormous man, dressed in an oilcloth slicker, had entered the tent and removed his hat. He was bald as a stone, and he had no trace of beard, and he had no brows to his eyes, nor lashes to them. He was close on to 7 feet in height, and he stood smoking a cigar even in this nomadic house of God, and he seemed to have removed his hat only to chase the rain from it, for now he put it on again. The reverend had stopped his sermon altogether. There was no sound in the tent. All watched the man. He adjusted the hat and then pushed his way forward as far as the crate-board pulpit where the reverend stood, and there he turned to address the reverend's congregation. His face was serene and strangely childlike. His hands were small. He held them out.
"Ladies and gentlemen, I feel it my duty to inform you that the man holding this revival is an impostor. He holds no papers of divinity from any institution recognized or improvised. He is altogether devoid of the least qualification to the office he has usurped, and has only committed to memory a few passages from the good book for the purpose of lending to his fraudulent sermons some faint flavor of the piety he despises. In truth, the gentleman standing here before you, posing as a minister of the Lord, is not only totally illiterate, but is also wanted by the law in the states of Tennessee, Kentucky, Mississippi, and Arkansas."
"Oh, God!" cried the reverend. "Lies, lies!"
He began reading feverishly from his open Bible.
"On a variety of charges, the most recent of which involved a girl of 11 years... I said 11, who had come to him in trust and whom he was surprised in the act of violating while actually clothed in the livery of his God."
A moan swept through the crowd. A lady sank to her knees.
"This is him," cried the reverend, sobbing. "This is him, the devil. Here he stands."
"Let's hang the turd,"
called an ugly thug from the gallery to the rear.
"Not 3 weeks before this, he was run out of Fort Smith, Arkansas, for having Congress with a goat." "Yes, lady, that is what I said. Goat."
"Why, damn my eyes if I won't shoot the son of a bitch,"
said a man rising at the far side of the tent, and drawing a pistol from his boot, he leveled it and fired. The young teamster instantly produced a knife from his clothing and unseamed the tent and stepped outside into the rain. The kid followed. They ducked low and ran across the mud toward the hotel. Already gunfire was general within the tent, and a dozen exits had been hacked through the canvas walls, and people were pouring out, women screaming, folk stumbling, folk trampled underfoot in the mud. The kid and his friend reached the hotel gallery and wiped the water from their eyes and turned to watch. As they did so, the tent began to sway and buckle, and like a huge and wounded Medusa, it slowly settled to the ground, trailing tattered canvas walls and ratty guy ropes over the ground. The bald-headed man was already at the bar when they entered. On the polished wood before him were 2 hats and a double handful of coins. He raised his glass, but not to them. They stood up to the bar and ordered whiskies, and the kid laid his money down, but the barman pushed it back with his thumb and nodded.
"These here's on the judge," he said.
They drank. The teamster set his glass down and looked at the kid, or he seemed to. You couldn't be sure of his gaze. The kid looked down the bar to where the judge stood. The bar was that tall, not every man could even get his elbows up on it, but it came just to the judge's waist. And he stood with his hands placed flatwise on the wood, leaning slightly, as if about to give another address. By now, men were piling through the doorway, bleeding, covered in mud, cursing. They gathered about the judge. A posse was being drawn to pursue the preacher. "Judge, how'd you come to have the goods on that no account?"
"Goods?" said the judge.
"When was you in Fort Smith?"
"Fort Smith?
Where did you know him to know all that stuff on him?"
"You mean the Reverend Green?"
"Yes, sir. I reckon you was in Fort Smith before you come out here."
"I was never in Fort Smith in my life. Doubt that he was."
They looked from one to the other. "Well, where was it you run up on him?"
"I never laid eyes on the man before today. Never even heard of him."
He raised his glass and drank. There was a strange silence in the room. The men looked like mud effigies. Finally, someone began to laugh. Then another. Soon they were all laughing together. Someone bought the judge a drink.
It had been raining for 16 days when he met Toadvine, and it was raining yet. He was still standing in the same saloon, and he had drunk up all his money, save $2. The teamster had gone. The room was all but empty. The door stood open, and you could see the rain falling in the empty lot behind the hotel. He drained his glass and went out. There were boards laid across the mud, and he followed the paling band of doorlight down toward the Batboard Jakes at the bottom of the lot. Another man was coming up from the Jakes, and they met halfway on the narrow planks. The man before him swayed slightly. His wet hat brim fell to his shoulders, save in the front where it was pinned back. He held a bottle loosely in one hand.
"You better get out of my way," he said.
The kid wasn't going to do that, and he saw no use in discussing it. He kicked the man in the jaw. The man went down and got up again. He said,
"I'm gonna kill you."
He swung with the bottle, and the kid ducked, and he swung again, and the kid stepped back. When the kid hit him, the man shattered the bottle against the side of his head. He went off the boards into the mud, and the man lunged after him with the jagged bottleneck and tried to stick it in his eye. The kid was fending with his hands, and they were slick with blood. He kept trying to reach into his boot for his knife.
"Kill your ass," the man said.
They slogged about in the dark of the lot, coming out of their boots. The kid had his knife now, and they circled crabwise, and when the man lurched at him, he cut the man's shirt open. The man threw down the bottleneck and unsheathed an immense bowie knife from behind his neck. His hat had come off, and his black and ropey locks swung about his head, and he had codified his threats to the one word "kill" like a crazed chant.
"Denton's cut," said one of several men standing along the walkway watching.
"Kill, kill,"
slobbered the man, wading forward. But someone else was coming down the lot, great steady sucking sounds like a cow. He was carrying a huge shillelagh. He reached the kid first, and when he swung with the club, the kid went face down in the mud. He'd have died if someone hadn't turned him over. When he woke, it was daylight, and the rain had stopped, and he was looking up into the face of a man with long hair who was completely covered in mud. The man was saying something to him.
"What?"
said the kid.
"I said, are you quits?"
"Quits?"
"Quits. 'Cause if you want some more of me, you sure as hell gonna get it."
He looked at the sky. Very high, very small, a buzzard. He looked at the man.
"Is my neck broke?"
he said. The man looked out over the lot and spat and looked at the boy again.
"Can you not get up?"
"I don't know. I ain't tried."
"I never meant to break your neck."
"No.
I meant to kill you."
"Ain't nobody done it yet."
He clawed at the mud and pushed himself up. The man was sitting on the planks with his boots alongside him.
"There ain't nothing wrong with you," he said.
The kid looked about stiffly at the day.
"Where's my boots?"
he said. The man squinted at him. Flakes of dried mud fell from his face.
"I'm gonna have to kill some son of a bitch if they got my boots."
"Yonder looks like one of them."
The kid labored off through the mud and fetched up one boot. He slogged about in the yard, feeling likely lumps of mud.
"This your knife?"
he said. The man squinted at him.
"Looks like it,"
he said. The kid pitched it to him, and he bent and picked it up and wiped the huge blade on his trouser leg.
"Thought somebody done stole you,"
he told the knife. The kid found his other boot and came and sat on the boards. His hands were huge with mud, and he wiped one of them briefly at his knee and let it fall again. They sat there side by side looking out across the barren lot. There was a picket fence at the edge of the lot, and beyond the fence a boy was drawing water at a well, and there were chickens in the yard there. A man came from the dram shop door down the walk toward the outhouse. He stopped where they sat and looked at them, and then stepped off into the mud. After a while he came back and stepped off into the mud again and went around and on up the walk. The kid looked at the man. His head was strangely narrow, and his hair was plastered up with mud in a bizarre and primitive coiffure. On his forehead were burned the letters HT, and lower, and almost between the eyes, the letter F. And these markings were splayed and garish, as if the iron had been left too long. When he turned to look at the kid could see that he had no ears. He stood up and sheathed the knife and started up the walk with the boots in his hand, and the kid rose and followed. Halfway to the hotel, the man stopped and looked out at the mud and then sat down on the planks and pulled on the boots, mud and all. Then he rose and slogged off through the lot to pick something up.
"I want you to look here," he said, "at my goddamn hat." You couldn't tell what it was. Something dead.
He flapped it about and pulled it over his head and went on, and the kid followed. The dram house was a long, narrow hall, wainscoted with varnished boards. There were tables by the wall and spittoons on the floor. There were no patrons. The barman looked up when they entered, and a nigger that had been sweeping the floor stood the broom against the wall and went out.
"Where's Sidney?"
said the man in his suit of mud.
"In the bed, I reckon."
They went on.
"Toadvine,"
called the barman. The kid looked back. The barman had come from behind the bar and was looking after them. They crossed from the door through the lobby of the hotel toward the stairs, leaving varied forms of mud behind them on the floor. As they started up the stairs, the clerk at the desk leaned and called to them.
"Toadvine!"
He stopped and looked back.
"He'll shoot you."
"Old Sidney.
Old Sidney."
They went on up the stairs. At the top of the landing was a long hall with a window light at the end. There were varnished doors down the walls, set so close they might have been closets. Toadvine went on until he came to the end of the hall. He listened at the last door, and he eyed the kid.
"You got a match?"
The kid searched his pockets and came up with a crushed and stained wooden box. The man took it from him. "Need a little tinder here," he said. He was crumbling the box and stacking the bits against the door. He struck a match and set the pieces alight. He pushed the little pile of burning wood under the door and added more matches.
"Is he in there?"
said the boy. "That's what we're fixing to see." A dark curl of smoke rose, a blue flame of burning varnish. They squatted in the hallway and watched. Thin flames began to run up over the panels and dart back again. The watchers looked like forms excavated from a bog. "Tap on the door now," said Toadvine. The kid rose. Toadvine stood up and waited. They could hear the flames crackling inside the room. The kid tapped.
"You better tap louder than that. This man drank some."
He balled his fist and lambasted the door about 5 times.
"Hellfire!" said a voice.
"Here he comes." They waited.
"You hot son of a bitch," said the voice.
Then the knob turned and the door opened. He stood in his underwear, holding in one hand the towel he'd used to turn the doorknob with. When he saw them, he turned and started back into the room, but Toadvine seized him about the neck and rode him to the floor and held him by the hair and began to pry out an eyeball with his thumb. The man grabbed his wrist and bit it.
"Kick his mouth in," called Toadvine. "Kick it!"
The kid stepped past them into the room and turned and kicked the man in the face. Toadvine held his head back by the hair.
"Kick him," he called. "Oh, kick him, honey."
He kicked. Toadvine pulled the bloody head around and looked at it and let it flop to the floor. And he rose and kicked the man himself. Two spectators were standing in the hallway. The door was completely afire and part of the wall and ceiling. They went out and down the hall. The clerk was coming up the steps two at a time.
"Toadvine, you son of a bitch," he said.
Toadvine was 4 steps above him, and when he kicked him, he caught him in the throat. The clerk sat down on the stairs. When the kid came past, he hit him on the side of the head, and the clerk slumped over and began to slide toward the landing. The kid stepped over him and went down to the lobby and crossed to the front door and out. Toadvine was running down the street, waving his fists above his head crazily and laughing. He looked like a great clay voodoo doll made animate, and the kid looked like another. Behind them, flames were licking at the top corner of the hotel, and clouds of dark smoke rose into the warm Texas morning. He'd left the mule with a Mexican family that boarded animals at the edge of town, and he arrived there wild-looking and out of breath. The woman opened the door and looked at him.
"Need to get my mule," he wheezed.
She looked at him some more. Then she called toward the back of the house. He walked around. There were horses tethered in the lot, and there was a flatbed wagon against the fence with some turkeys sitting on the edge looking out. The old lady had come to the back door.
"Nito," she called. "Venga, hay un caballero aquí. Venga."
He went down the shed to the tack room and got his wretched saddle and his blanket roll and brought them back. He found the mule and unstalled it and bridled it with the rawhide hackamore and led it to the fence. He leaned against the animal with his shoulder and got the saddle over it and got it cinched, the mule starting and shying and running its head along the fence. He led it across the lot. The mule kept shaking its head sideways as if it had something in its ear. He led it out to the road. As he passed the house, the woman came padding out after him. When she saw him put his foot on the stirrup, she began to run. He swung up into the broken saddle and chucked the mule forward. She stopped at the gate and watched him go. He didn't look back. When he passed back through the town, the hotel was burning, and men were standing around watching it, some holding empty buckets. A few men sat horseback watching the flames, and one of these was the judge. As the kid rode past, the judge turned and watched him. He turned the horse, as if he'd have the animal watch too. When the kid looked back, the judge smiled. The kid touched up the mule, and they went sucking out past the old stone fort along the road west. Chapter 2. Across the prairie, a hermit, a nigger's heart, a stormy night. Westward again, cattle drovers, their kindness. On the trail again, the dead cart. San Antonio de Bear, a Mexican cantina. Another fight, the abandoned church, the dead in the sacristy. At the ford, bathing in the river. Now come days of begging, days of theft, days of riding where there rode no soul save he. He's left behind the pinewood country, and the evening sun declines before him beyond an endless swale, and dark falls here like a thunderclap, and a cold wind sets the weeds to gnashing. The night sky lies so sprent with stars that there is scarcely space of black at all, and they fall all night in bitter arcs. And it is so that their numbers are no less. He keeps from off the king's road for fear of citizenry. The little prairie wolves cry all night, and dawn finds him in a grassy draw where he'd gone to hide from the wind. The hobbled mule stands over him and watches the east for light. The sun that rises is the color of steel. His mounted shadow falls for miles before him. He wears on his head a hat he's made from leaves, and they have dried and cracked in the sun, and he looks like a raggedy man wandered from some garden where he'd used to frighten birds. Come evening, he tracks a spire of smoke rising oblique from among the low hills, and before dark he hails up at the doorway of an old anchorite, nested away in the sod like a ground sloth. Solitary, half-mad, his eyes red-rimmed as if locked in their cages with hot wires. But a ponderable body for that. He watched wordless while the kid eased down stiffly from the mule. A rough wind was blowing, and his rags flapped about him.
"Seen ye smoke," said the kid, "that you might spare a man a sup of water."
The old hermit scratched in his filthy hair and looked at the ground. He turned and entered the hut, and the kid followed. Inside, darkness and a smell of earth. A small fire burned on the dirt floor, and the only furnishings were a pile of hides in one corner. The old man shuffled through the gloom, his head bent to clear the low ceiling of woven limbs and mud. He pointed down to where a bucket stood in the dirt. The kid bent and took up the gourd floating there and dipped and drank. The water was salty, sulphurous. He drank on.
"You reckon I could water my old mule out there?"
The old man began to beat his palm with one fist and dart his eyes about.
"Be proud to fetch in some fresh. Just tell me where it's at."
"What you aim to water him with?"
The kid looked at the bucket and he looked around in the dim hut.
"I ain't drinking after no mule," said the hermit.
"Have you not got no old bucket nor nothing?"
"No," cried the hermit. "No, I ain't."
He was clapping the heels of his clenched fists together at his chest. The kid rose and looked toward the door.
"I'll find something," he said. "Where's the well at?"
"Up the hill. Follow the path."
"It's nigh too dark to see out here."
"It's a deep path. Follow your feet. Follow your mule. I can't go."
He stepped out into the wind and looked about for the mule, but the mule wasn't there. Far to the south, lightning flared soundlessly. He went up the path among the thrashing weeds and found the mule standing at the well. A hole in the sand with rocks piled about it, a piece of dry hide for a cover, and a stone to weight it down. There was a rawhide bucket with a rawhide bale and a rope of greasy leather. The bucket had a rock tied to the bale to help it tip and fill, and he lowered it until the rope in his hand went slack while the mule watched over his shoulder. He drew up 3 bucketfuls and held them so the mule wouldn't spill them, and then he put the cover back over the well and led the mule back down the path to the hut.
"I thank ye for the water," he called.
The hermit appeared darkly in the door.
"Just stay with me," he said.
"That's all right."
"Best stay. It's fixin' to storm."
"You reckon?"
"I reckon, and I reckon right."
"Well, bring ye bed. Bring ye possibles."
He uncinched and threw down the saddle and hobbled the mule, foreleg to rear, and took his bedroll in. There was no light save the fire, and the old man was squatting by it tailor-wise.
Anywheres, he said. "Where's your saddle at?"
The kid gestured with his chin.
"Don't leave it out yonder. Some'll eat it. This is a hungry country."
He went out and ran into the mule in the dark. It had been standing looking in at the fire.
"Get away, fool," he said.
He took up the saddle and went back in.
"Now pull that door to before we blow away," said the old man.
The door was a mass of planks on leather hinges. He dragged it across the dirt and fastened it by its leather latch.
"I take it ye lost your way," said the hermit.
"No, I went right to it."
He waved quickly with his hand, the old man.
"No, no," he said. "I mean ye was lost to come here. Was there a sandstorm? Did ye drift off the road in the night? Did thieves beset ye?"
The kid pondered this.
"Yes," he said. "We got off the road some ways or another."
"Knowed ye did."
"How long have you been out here?"
"Out where?"
The kid was sitting on his blanket roll across the fire from the old man.
"Here," he said, "in this place."
The old man didn't answer. He turned his head suddenly aside and seized his nose between his thumb and forefinger and blew 2 strings of snot onto the floor and wiped his fingers on the seam of his jeans.
"I come from Mississippi. I was a slaver. Don't care to tell it. Made good money. I never did get caught. Just got sick of it. Sick of niggers. Wait till I show you something."
He turned and rummaged among the hides and handed through the flames a small dark thing. The kid turned it in his hand. Some man's heart, dried and blackened. He passed it back and the old man cradled it in his palm as if he'd weigh it.
"There's 4 things that can destroy the earth," he said. "Women, whiskey, money, and niggers."
They sat in silence. The wind moaned in the section of stovepipe that was run through the roof above them to quit the place of smoke. After a while, the old man put the heart away.
"That thing cost me $200, he said.
"You give $200 for it?"
"I did. For that was the price they poured on the black son of a bitch it hung inside of."
He stirred about in the corner and came up with an old dark brass kettle, lifted the cover and poked inside with 1 finger. The remains of 1 of the lank prairie hares interred in cold grease and furred with a light blue mold. He clamped the lid back on the kettle and set it in the flames.
"Ain't much, but we'll go shares," he said.
"I thank ye."
"Lost your way in the dark," said the old man.
He stirred the fire, standing slender tusks of bone up out of the ashes. The kid didn't answer. The old man swung his head back and forth.
The way of the transgressor is hard. God made this world, but he didn't make it to suit everybody, did he?
I don't believe he much had me in mind.
Aye, said the old man. But where does a man come by his notions? What world's he seen that he liked better? I can think of better places and better ways. Can you make it be?
No.
No. It's a mystery. A man's at odds to know his mind, 'cause his mind is aught he has to know it with. He can know his heart, but he don't want to. Rightly so. Best not to look in there. It ain't the heart of a creature that is bound in the way that God has set for it. You can find meanness in the least of creatures. But when God made man, the devil was at his elbow. A creature that can do anything. Make a machine. And a machine to make the machine. An evil that can run itself 1,000 years. No need to tend it. You believe that?
I don't know.
Believe that.
When the old man's mess was warmed, he doled it out and they ate in silence. Thunder was moving north, and before long it was booming overhead, and starting bits of rust in a thin trickle down the stovepipe. They hunkered over their plates and wiped the grease up with their fingers and drank from the gourd. The kid went out and scoured his cup and plate on the sand, and came back banging the tins together as if to fend away some dry gulch phantom out there in the dark. Distant thunderheads reared quivering against the electric sky and were sucked away in the blackness again. The old man sat with one ear cocked to the howling waste without. The kid shut the door.
Don't have no backy with you, do you?
No, I ain't, said the kid.
Didn't allow you did.
You reckon it'll rain?
It's got every opportunity. Likely it won't.
The kid watched the fire. Already he was nodding. Finally he raised up and shook his head. The hermit watched him over the dying flames.
Just go on, fix your bed, he said.
He did, spreading his blankets on the packed mud and pulling off his stinking boots. The flue pipe moaned, and he heard the mule stamp and snuffle outside, and in his sleep he struggled and muttered like a dreaming dog. He woke sometime in the night with the hut in almost total darkness, and the hermit bent over him and all but in his bed.
"What do you want?" he said.
But the hermit crawled away, and in the morning when he woke, the hut was empty, and he got his things and left. All that day he watched to the north a thin line of dust. It seemed not to move at all, and it was late evening before he could see that it was headed his way. He passed through a forest of live oak, and he watered at a stream and moved on in the dusk and made a fireless camp. Birds woke him where he lay in a dry and dusty wood. By noon he was on the prairie again, and the dust of the north was stretched out along the edge of the earth. By evening the first of a drove of cattle came into view, rangy, vicious beasts with enormous horn spreads. That night he sat on the herder's camp and ate beans and pilot bread and heard of life on the trail. They were coming down from Abilene, 40 days out, headed for the markets in Louisiana, followed by packs of wolves, coyotes, Indians. Cattle groaned about them for miles in the dark. They asked him no questions, a ragged lot themselves, crossbreed some, free niggers, an Indian or two.
I had my outfit stole, he said.
They nodded in the firelight.
They got everything I had. I ain't even got a knife.
You might could sign on with us. We lost two men. Turned back to go to California.
I'm headed yon way.
I guess you might be going to California your own self.
I might. I ain't decided.
Them boys was with us, fell in with a bunch from Arkansas. They was headed down for Bear, gonna pull for Mexico in the west. I bet them old boys is in Bear, drinking their brains out. I bet old Lonnie's done topped every whore in town.
How far is it to Bear?
It's about 2 days. It's further than that. More like 4, I'd say.
How would a man go if he had a mind to?
You cut straight south. You ought to hit the road about half a day. You going to Bear?
I might do.
You see old Lonnie down there, you tell him to get a piece for me. Tell him old Orrin. He'll buy you a drink if he ain't blowed all his money in.
In the morning they ate flapjacks with molasses, and the herders saddled up and moved on. When he found his mule, there was a small fiber bag tied to the animal's rope, and inside the bag there was a cupful of dried beans and some peppers and an old Green River knife with a handle made of string. He saddled up the mule, the mule's back galled and balding, the hooves cracked, the ribs like fish bones. They hobbled on across the endless plain. He came upon Bear in the evening of the fourth day, and he sat the tattered mule on a low rise and looked down at the town, the quiet adobe houses, the line of green oaks and cottonwoods that marked the course of the river, the plaza filled with wagons with their Osnaburg covers, and the whitewashed public buildings, and the Moorish church dome rising from the trees, and the garrison, and the tall stone powder house in the distance. A light breeze stirred the fronds of his hat, his matted greasy hair. His eyes lay dark and tunneled in a caved and haunted face, and a foul stench rose from the wells of his boot tops. The sun was just down, and to the west lay reefs of blood-red clouds, up out of which rose little desert nighthawks like fugitives from some great fire at the earth's end. He spat a dry, white spit and clumped the cracked wooden stirrups against the mule's ribs, and they staggered into motion again. He went down a narrow, sandy road, and as he went, he met a dead cart bound out with a load of corpses. A small bell tolling the way, and a lantern swinging from the gate. Three men sat on the box, not unlike the dead themselves, or spirit folk, so white they were with lime, and nearly phosphorescent in the dusk. A pair of horses drew the cart, and they went on up the road in a faint miasma of carbolic, and passed from sight. He turned and watched them go. The naked feet of the dead jostled stiffly from side to side. It was dark when he entered the town, attended by barking dogs, faces parting the curtains in the lamp-lit windows, the light clatter of the mule's hooves echoing in the little empty streets. The mule sniffed the air and swung down an alleyway into a square where there stood in the starlight a well, a trough, a hitching rail. The kid eased himself down and took the bucket from the stone coping and lowered it into the well. A light splash echoed. He drew the bucket, water dripping in the dark. He dipped the gourd and drank, and the mule nuzzled his elbow. When he'd done, he set the bucket in the street and sat on the coping of the well and watched the mule drink from the bucket. He went on through the town leading the animal. There was no one about. By and by he entered a plaza, and he could hear guitars and a horn. At the far end of the square there were lights from a cafe, and laughter, and high-pitched cries. He led the mule into the square and up the far side past a long portico toward the lights. There was a team of dancers in the street, and they wore gaudy costumes and called out in Spanish. He and the mule stood at the edge of the lights and watched. Old men sat along the tavern wall, and children played in the dust. They wore strange costumes, all. The men in dark, flat-crowned hats, white nightshirts, trousers that buttoned up the outside leg. and the girls with garish painted faces and tortoiseshell combs in their blue-black hair. The kid crossed the street with a mule and tied it and entered the cafe. A number of men were standing at the bar, and they quit talking when he entered. He crossed the polished clay floor past a sleeping dog that opened one eye and looked at him, and he stood at the bar and placed both hands on the tiles. The barman nodded to him.
"Digga me," he said.
"I ain't got no money, but I need a drink. I'll fetch out the slops or mop the floor or whatever."
The barman looked across the room to where two men were playing dominoes at a table.
"Abuelito,"
he said. The older of the two raised his head.
"¿Qué dice el muchacho?"
The old man looked at the kid and turned back to his dominoes. The barman shrugged his shoulders. The kid turned to the old man.
"You speak American?" he said.
The old man looked up from his play. He regarded the kid without expression.
"Tell him I'll work for a drink. I ain't got no money."
The old man thrust his chin and made a clucking noise with his tongue. The kid looked at the barman. The old man made a fist with the thumb pointing up and the little finger down, and tilted his head back and tipped a phantom drink down his throat.
"Quiere echarse una copa," he said. "Pero no puede pagar."
The men at the bar watched. The barman looked at the kid.
"Quiere trabajo," said the old man. "Quién sabe?"
He turned back to his pieces and made his play without further consultation.
"¿Quieres trabajar?"
said one of the men at the bar. They began to laugh.
"What are you laughing at?" said the boy.
They stopped. Some looked at him, some pursed their mouths or shrugged. The boy turned to the bartender.
"You got something I could do for a couple of drinks. I know damn good and well."
One of the men at the bar said something in Spanish. The boy glared at them. They winked one to the other. They took up their glasses. He turned to the barman again. His eyes were dark and narrow.
"Sweep the floor,"
he said. The barman blinked. The kid stepped back and made sweeping motions, a pantomime that bent the drinkers in silent mirth.
"Sweep,"
he said, pointing at the floor.
"No está sucio,"
said the barman. He swept again.
"Sweep, goddammit," he said.
The barman shrugged. He went to the end of the bar and got a broom and brought it back. The boy took it and went on to the back of the room. A great hall of a place. He swept in the corners where potted trees stood silent in the dark. He swept around the spittoons, and he swept around the players at the table, and he swept around the dog. He swept along the front of the bar, and when he reached the place where the drinkers stood, he straightened up and leaned on the broom and looked at them. They conferred silently among themselves, and at last one took his glass from the bar and stepped away. The others followed. The kid swept past them to the door. The dancers had gone, the music. Across the street sat a man on a bench dimly lit in the door light from the cafe. The mule stood where he'd tied it. He tapped the broom on the steps and came back in and took the broom to the corner where the barman had gotten it. Then he came to the bar and stood. The barman ignored him. The kid rapped with his knuckles. The barman turned and put one hand on his hip and pursed his lips.
"How about that drink now?"
said the kid. The barman stood. The kid made the drinking motions that the old man had made, and the barman flapped his towel idly at him.
"Andale,"
he said. He made a shooing motion with the back of his hand. The kid's face clouded.
"You son of a bitch,"
he said. He started down the bar. The barman's expression didn't change. He brought up from under the bar an old-fashioned military pistol with a flintlock and shoved back the cock with the heel of his hand. A great wooden clicking in the silence. a clicking of glasses all down the bar. Then the scuffling of chairs pushed back by the players at the wall. The kid froze.
"Old man," he said.
The old man didn't answer. There was no sound in the cafe. The kid turned to find him with his eyes.
"Está borracho,"
said the old man. The boy watched the barman's eyes. The barman waved the pistol toward the door. The old man spoke to the room in Spanish, then he spoke to the barman. Then he put on his hat and went out. The barman's face drained. When he came around the end of the bar, he had laid down the pistol, and he was carrying a bung starter in one hand. The kid backed to the center of the room, and the barman labored over the floor toward him like a man on his way to some chore. He swung twice at the kid, and the kid stepped twice to the right. Then he stepped backward. The barman froze. The kid boosted himself lightly over the bar and picked up the pistol. No one moved. He raked the frizzen open against the bar top and dumped the priming out and laid the pistol down again. Then he selected a pair of full bottles from the shelves behind him and came around the end of the bar with one in each hand. The barman stood in the center of the room. He was breathing heavily, and he turned, following the kid's movements. When the kid approached him, he raised the bung starter. The kid crouched lightly with the bottles and fainted, and then broke the right one over the man's head. Blood and liquor sprayed, and the man's knees buckled and his eyes rolled. The kid had already let go the bottleneck, and he pitched the second bottle into his right hand in a road agent's pass before it even reached the floor. And he backhanded the second bottle across the barman's skull and crammed the jagged remnant into his eye as he went down. The kid looked around the room. Some of those men wore pistols in their belts, but none moved. The kid vaulted the bar and took another bottle and tucked it under his arm and walked out the door. The dog was gone. The man on the bench was gone, too. He untied the mule and led it across the square. He woke in the nave of a ruinous church, blinking up at the vaulted ceiling and the tall, swagged walls with their faded frescoes. The floor of the church was deep in dry guano and the droppings of cattle and sheep. Pigeons flapped through the piers of dusty light, and three buzzards hobbled about on the picked bone carcass of some animal dead in the chancel. His head was in torment, and his tongue swollen with thirst. He sat up and looked around him. He'd put the bottle under his saddle, and he found it, and held it up and shook it, and drew the cork and drank. He sat with his eyes closed, the sweat beaded on his forehead. Then he opened his eyes and drank again. The buzzards stepped down one by one and trotted off into the sacristy. After a while he rose and went out to look for the mule. It was nowhere in sight. The mission occupied 8 or 10 acres of enclosed land, a barren purlieu that held a few goats and burros. In the mud walls of the enclosure were cribs inhabited by families of squatters, and a few cook fires smoked thinly in the sun. He walked around the side of the church and entered the sacristy. Buzzards shuffled off through the chaff and plaster like enormous yard fowl. The domed vaults overhead were clotted with a dark, furred mass that shifted and breathed and chittered. In the room was a wooden table with a few clay pots, and along the back wall lay the remains of several bodies, one a child. He went on through the sacristy into the church again and got his saddle. He drank the rest of the bottle, and he put the saddle on his shoulder and went out. The facade of the building bore an array of saints in their niches, and they had been shot up by American troops trying their rifles. The figures shorn of ears and noses and darkly mottled with lead marks oxidized upon the stone. The huge carved and paneled doors hung awap on their hinges, and a carved stone virgin held in her arms a headless child. He stood blinking in the noon heat. Then he saw the mule's tracks. They were just the palest disturbance of the dust, and they came out of the door of the church and crossed the lot to the gate in the east wall. He hiked the saddle higher on